excitement, the sheer joy of the quarterfinal for England World Cup Women, and we'll be speaking to Faye White to talk about that later. Faye White, of course, very much one of the fantastic lionesses from times past, and of course these days a great commentator as well. Meanwhile, Gabriella, I think you know what we need to say at this particular moment in time, where in Gibraltar it's 2.5 minutes past 9 a.m. Don't worry, if you're in Lincoln, England, it's 2.5 minutes past 8 a.m. That's time zones for you. What's happening, Gabriella?
Weather.
Exactly. Right. That's precisely it. You know, you could not have said it better if you actually read the script. So go for it.
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 19 degrees centigrade, lows of 10 degrees centigrade, and it would be a day of sunny intervals with a moderate breeze.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Hurrah. I love the delivery there, Gabriella. It's almost as if you were listening to our piece with Sarah Huntley last night, when we were talking about energy and delivery and really being up for it. A voice that is energised in the morning, makes you want to really go out and experience that Lincoln weather, even if you're in Gibraltar. But there we are. How is the weather in Gibraltar, actually? We rarely ask you these days, because we expect it to be usually sunny.
Well, the weather in Gibraltar is quite a lot better than Lincoln, sorry to say. But I think today is going to be highs of 25 with a low of 20.
Oh, well, there we are.
Sunny day, and that's actually been lower than we've had the past few days. Usually we've been getting 27, 28. So...
Well,
yeah,
still,
it's full summer here.
The key thing is, make sure you wear sunscreen. Last week was the Lincolnshire show, so it rained, which is important. It's very important that that's there. Who knows what happens in a couple of weeks' time? We'll be covering the Great Yorkshire Show, and of course, Nigel Pulling will be joining us from the Great Yorkshire Show on Wednesday to chat about that. Meanwhile, Gabriella, these rock-shaped protective barriers. So Joe has already said, so what makes a rock-shaped rock rock-shaped? That's pretty much it. I mean, as a geologist, you're probably sort of a geographer. Geology.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a typical rock shape at all.
It's
a
reference to the shape of the Gibraltar rock.
Yes.
The rock of Gibraltar. So we just call it the rock.
Got you.
As opposed to the actor of the same name, who, of course, could be standing for the United States presidency in the not-too-distant future.
See, we did there.
Thank you, Progress. I do work on these things. Talk to us about this feature, the new rock-shaped protective barriers installed on the main street. Is it going to have any impact, or is it just a case of, interesting enough, the protective Jersey barriers? Where's the wrong island? You know, that's a completely different part of the world, Jersey. You want Gibraltar-shaped things there. Why have they actually put on board this decision to actually put in these barriers to beautify and enhance the town area?
The answer isn't as nice as that sounds, the real answer. They were implemented well over a year ago after the London Bridge terror attacks. So because of recent years of terrorists choosing to drive in main roads and pedestrianised areas, well, Main Street is our high street, which is fully pedestrianised, and has delivery cars visit it every single morning. So to, the threat level went up in Europe after all these terror attacks, so Gibraltar followed and put these barriers in place. So they look really nice, which is good. They used to just look like white blocks on the street, and now we've made them look nice, so it looks fine in the town. You don't notice it too much, and yes, maybe you think it's a nice statue, but actually it's to stop any if there was any driver, they would crash into it, basically.
I'm thinking,
or they wouldn't be able, if they were trying to go fast, they wouldn't be able to maneuver through the high street, because these blocks at different certain points, there's quite a few of them across the street. So that's why it doesn't sound as nice as beautifying the street.
But surely they're crying out for some kind of Gibraltarian Banksy to actually go and graffiti all over them and actually put them in different colours, you know, sky blue in Manchester City possibly, and various other aspects.
Well, we have
there.
Others as well in another road, and they've been left alone. So I'm just hoping these ones do too.
What, left alone?
But we haven't had any graffiti on. Yeah, they haven't had any graffiti on the others.
Surely somebody's going to put on, you know, Gabriella Rules, R-O-O-L-Z, you know, from that point of view. Maybe not. Joe, you've been looking at these rocks of Gibraltar. Any thoughts, any comments, or do you want to take us off on a completely different line?
I'd love to take you off on a completely different line. Mm-hmm. So we were talking last time I came in about the history, the geological history of the area. And I mentioned that actually Gibraltar and the gap there was once the location of the largest ever waterfall that's been observed. Well, not observed, because it was about
time travelers.
A long time ago.
Time travellers, possibly, might have actually observed it that we don't know of.
Yeah, so it was at the end of something called the Salinity Crisis, which was when the Mediterranean pretty much dried up. So there wasn't an awful lot of water left in the Mediterranean. It was almost completely empty, just salt. And then there was a change in sea level. Plate tectonics played a role as well. And what happened was that you had a breach at that gap at Gibraltar Point, not Gibraltar Point, sorry, at Gibraltar. And yeah. The water came in from the Atlantic and flowed over there, and it actually filled up the Mediterranean within anything between sort of months to years. Filled up the entire Mediterranean.
Like a giant bath.
Yeah, like a giant bathtub.
So there we are, Gabrielle. That's going to help you with that piece of information to actually get through the day, I would have thought. Yeah, you drop it in there. So you forget the sort of notion of the rocks in the street. What about us being on the site of the largest ever waterfall the world has ever seen, or just Europe?
There might be something in America, but
isn't there always America, you know, but somewhere? I mean, you know, surely they should actually sort of just say, look, they've got the Grand Canyon, they've got that sort of asteroid system that's actually there. Why do they need to actually claim waterfalls as well? It's, you know, Donald will get on the case. Not that I'm on personal terms with the President of the United States. That could have been referring to Donald Duck. There we are. And many people would say there's no difference. However, we won't go down a political line, although I think it's fair to say that Richard Fitzwilliams will be talking about the royal budgets that have been out there. I personally don't think if we've got to give Europe back £39 billion, we'll be able to afford to keep the royals for much longer. So maybe they should actually just be sent over to your good self in Gibraltar, Gabrielle, and you can look after them. Because, you know, we've got to pay all sorts of things depending on who gets into power. Only kidding. It's only 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock. And it's time, Gabrielle, for Fergus to put those last two questions to you.
So, Gabriella, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
I have, thank you.
And will you be joining us again?
Yep, next week, I hope. Yeah.
That's what we'd like to hear. Get that drum out, play it, and have a good day.
What's
He's lied his way through life. He's lied his way through politics. He's a huckster with a degree of charm to which I am immune. As well as being mendacious, he's incompetent. Well, not my words, but as quoted last night, Chris Patton talking about Boris Johnson. And as we just said, as we're going up to Richard Fitzwilliam's, allowing for the extortionate amount of money that's being spent on our royal family. Can't afford it anymore, I'm sorry. And whoever, Boris or Jeremy, if we're going to cover these sort of costs and the Brexit bill, etc., we'll have to just do without the royal family. We'll need to go off to Gibraltar and leave it there. Isn't that right, Richard?
Why, Alex, it could never be said that you had a provocative side. I mean, it's true, in the last, you know, I must be frank, in the last couple of days, I have had a tough time because the royal accounts, on the whole, there were several stories in them, including the refurbishment of Buckingham Palace, which has now finally begun. It hadn't been done since just after the war, in a lot of cases, boilers, wiring, all of this. It's massive, £370 million over 10 years, and the way the funding's arranged, just to explain it to listeners, in 1760, George III swapped the civil of the Crown lands, which because he was heavily in debt for the civil list. It was not a pact that was beneficial to the monarchy as a whole, but there it is. It lasted till 2012. Problem with the civil list, it used to be fixed at the beginning of a reign, and then inflation eroded and so on. So they came up with a sovereign grant, which was 15% of the profits from the civil list, and that's been augmented by a further 10% when it is being used for the Buckingham Palace refurbishment. This excludes security, 1.24p per person, but that was not what people were interested in discussing. What they wanted to discuss was the fact that the sovereign grant includes the renovation of Crown properties. If a member of the royal family is staying in one or choosing one to live in, they get refurbished by the taxpayer, and Harry and Meghan didn't choose the apartment that they had the option of doing in Kensington Palace. They chose to...
Richard, that's because Meghan's American. Large is better. A huge national stereotype there that I'm actually referring to.
Large. I mean, it's not that large. I mean, that national stereotype is also Kensington Palace is at a pretty big apartment they were going to get. The point is, they wanted independence. The other point, obviously, privacy is important. They had they rented a hideaway in the Cotswolds, and there was a paparazzi helicopter. Not that the paparazzi have got a place that they can... They haven't got sources these days, thank goodness. But even so, that meant they had to leave it. The privacy, it was paramount, and the fact that they paid for some of the, shall we say, furniture, fittings, the like, I suspect that came out of the revenue of the Prince of Wales, though that was not specified. There's an amount that includes in the Clarence House accounts, there's an amount that actually includes expenditure on the Cambridges, Sussexes, and other matters. But But the facts of the matter were, it's 2.4 million and the taxpayer, not entirely finished yet, and the taxpayer, on the whole, was not suddenly, with the reception I got on air, pleased about it.
Well,
and
of course not, Richard, because the media has basically pumped us up into how much we actually owe, how much the country's actually in deficit and all sorts of things. But let's test it with Josephine Westlake.
That's what I was hoping to do.
Joe, any thoughts? So as a case of royals, I'd like to go Republican now.
Absolutely not. No, I am completely a royalist. I love our royal family. And I think that if you think about the size of our country, I think the royal family, particularly the Queen, give us a lot more perceived power than we would have
otherwise. Boris Johnson?
I don't think I'm staying away from that one.
Dominic Grieve, I'm afraid he's shown, especially during his period as Foreign Secretary.
You mustn't bring out in the names of all these politicians. It'll confuse. The Royal Council, Alex, I rarely step in this way, but it's so confusing for the listener. And if you mention Dominic Grieve, they won't know what's going on.
Well, neither does he. He doesn't have the necessary skills and capacity to be a leader. That's his line. I won't sort of have any other quotes. I could go on and on. But you were saying, in essence, so you're very much in favour, Joe?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I was saying, I think that the perceived power that we get from them having the monarchy is worth any money that we spend on it.
Okay.
Because without that, we would presumably become...
Luxembourg.
Have a president? Do we want a president? Do you want President Boris Johnson? I'm not entirely sure.
This is not a pleasing way to actually launch on a Thursday.
It's the way politics are. But I mean, the facts of the matter are, I think, the very admirable summary of so much of what the royals do. Look, what the charitable work is so important. Look at William.
Richard, we haven't quite finished yet because, as we were discussing last night, of course, from the city that has Richard III buried, in a car park. Fergus, what are your views on the royal family? Do you echo Joe's, or is it a case of saying, no, I'd quite like to have a president?
Well, I think they do offer something to the UK. Like, it's kind of a part of the UK's kind of iconography. It's like,
for however long we have the United Kingdom, of course.
Yeah. I sometimes watch the royal weddings when they happen. Like, I saw Harry and Meghan's, I saw William and Kate's, but I don't know, I'm kind of in the middle, in between them. I don't want to get rid of them, can't live with them.
Okay, well, Richard, I mean, that's fairly positive overall in terms of representing the country, shall we say. Maybe, you know, there is a sea change.
Well, we do now, Alex. Just to run through a few quick points to the charitable side, and I think it was so important what William was saying about George or Charlotte or Louis were LGBT, they would be totally in favour, and this was just one example. You talk about mental illness, they're starting a conversation with Harry, William, Meghan and Kate, and also Harry and Invictus, William and the Trust, and one could go on, but in fact there was a very interesting statistic that came out of the Royal Accounts, and that was the Prince's Trust, which the Prince began in 1976 with his naval severance pay. It's now just expanded abroad, and it's got helped a million young people disadvantaged. Now, that's an amazing statistic. Whatever you think of the monarchy, that is extraordinary. That got completely submerged, and as did the Buckingham Palace refurbishment. It simply had to happen. Good heavens, if people grudge the royals an extra £370 million over 10 years, you might look at what's happening in the Palace of Westminster and the political chaos. The monarchy, a politically neutral, pivotal for national unity. This is so important. They're above party politics, and there's the Commonwealth link, there's the fact they're the world's most high-profile monarchy, there's also the link, of course, for tourism. A large number of tourists visit Britain will confirm that, and also, I mean, you've got the soft power projection abroad and the help for British business.
Okay, Richard, you've made the case.
Alex, the way you cut my answers, it grieves me. And all I can say is,
and it's been echoed by Joe Westlake, so this particular moment in time.
And I hope, incidentally, I must mention Royal Ascot, because that was terrific. This is the first week the Queen in pencils in her diary because it's one that she absolutely loves and it's rather fun. They bet on the Queen's hat. And this was a glorious, glorious 5 days. I did win on a lot of the horses, I have to say. The last couple of years, it's been lucky. Usually it isn't. But I go just to see the glorious kaleidoscope of colour, and it really is. Some of those races are very exciting. Some of the people look fantastic, some don't, but mostly the standard was very, very high because they've clamped down in the last 7 years on the dress code. Interesting that Beau Brummel, who had drew up the first dress code for Royal Ascot in 1807, was such a fan of cravats. They've been banned now, and indeed they're letting jumpsuits in. We saw the Countess of Wessex not look particularly good in one of them, I thought, but nonetheless, it's the scale of it that's so impressive.
And I won't have anything said against Sophie, Countess of Wessex, just let's leave it there.
I think she's absolutely fair.
Ever since you stopped wearing a fascinator, Richard, it just hasn't been the same for me, Royal Ascot, but never mind.
You're, of course, referring, Alex is referring to the fact that fascinators, this is a serious question. He introduces these things, you see, he the way he pricks us and launches fascinators into this, what was happening, and this is true, they allowed fascinators in, and people were sticking two feathers in their hair and just wandering into the enclosure. Now it's got to be 3 inches in diameter, that hat, and if it isn't, there are people who will make sure it is.
Yeah. And that possibly is part of the reason why so many Europeans just find Britain quite hilarious at present. Anyway.
Well, you know, we had the King and Queen of the Netherlands. I was wondering who the lady was, because I after a party and picnic and Harpock one, I wandered in to see the Queen, of course, come in. And there was this wonderful looking, the lady next door. I had this glorious, glorious hat, but it was above that. The Queen, you didn't normally get that. It really was a flower, you could say a
flower power extravaganza.
Beautiful. And it was the Queen of the King and Queen of the Netherlands. The Queen had made the King of Spain and the King of the Netherlands Knights of the Garter in the ceremony. I've seen it in previous years sometimes, and it really is a medieval tableau come to life. It's our oldest order of chivalry dating back to Edward III in 1348, and that was on the Monday, and the King and Queen stayed and were in the royal carriage, and Tuesday really was a wonderful turnout of the royal family. William and Kate don't go that often. They've only been 3 times, I think, since they married, and they've 6 years or 5 years
such
before
a,
they went
such a shame they didn't actually realise that the real social event to be at last week, of course, was the 2019 Lincolnshire show. However, let us move on.
Me, of course. I mean, I wouldn't. I was only giving Ascot, you know.
Of course. Exactly, which is fine. Now, this evening, very, very, very important game in association football for the wonderful Lionesses, who hopefully with Steph Houghton, if she recovers from injury after the brutalising she had against Cameroon, will actually be going up against the women of Norway in the quarterfinal of the FIFA World Cup. I mention that because not only are we featuring Faye White, but back in 1986, before Fergus was actually born, and I suspect probably even Joe, I don't know if I can say anything, there was an incident that took place in Mexico with a gentleman who basically went on quite rightly to be punished by the Almighty for claiming that it was the hand of God that effectively led him to effectively beat or at least score a goal against Peter Shilton and Bobby Robson's fine English Lions at the time. He now has a movie made after him, and he's had lots of challenges in all sorts of ways, and I believe you did not know the story of Diego Maradona, Richard Fitzwilliams, for shame, for shame.
There you have it. You see, you admit something, and Alex twists the knife in, and he waits 10 minutes, and he does it with panache and cleverly. You see how cruel he can be. That was a splendid introduction. I have to give it credit. And this is a documentary about Diego Maradona. It is true that I knew remarkably little about him, and I have to say that there's one benefit that I got from this, and that was that I didn't know what was coming in this film, and it will rivet you. And the extraordinary thing is, firstly, you're absolutely right, the hand of God that helped the victory of Argentina against England in 1986. I mean, that, how it was missed and so forth, this is football legend. Now, the other second goal, which he also scored,
That was better. That was better. The second goal was better.
Well, it was a dribble so extraordinary that it was named the goal of the century. What you see in this film is how a kid from the slums of Argentina becomes one of the greatest footballers of all time, and you see also a great deal about his flaws, and also if you are based in Naples and lead Naples to victory, there are gentlemen, to use your phrase...
Hey, the mafioso, the brotherhood, the Cosa Nostra.
That's right. Yes. And that, one of the interesting aspects of this movie is I'm not going to go through what's in it, or a lot of what's in it, because it will spring surprises. If you don't know the story, it will rivet you simply because it's such an extraordinary tale. It's absolutely fascinating. Known as the Golden Boy, that capacity, you could almost describe it as balletic in a sense, the way he moves past multiple players on the pitch. And indeed, Barcelona, Naples, the international career with Argentina, the World Cups he played in, the famous Hand of God incident that Alex has referred to, from someone in the slums in Argentina who became world famous. But of course, as so many who price of fame, we see this in detail. We see also a private life with a whole series of problems, and we see what happens when you lead Naples to victory, but of course your home's Argentina and footballers move around. What if you happen to be with the Argentinian team playing Italy? And what happens then in years afterwards when, do they like it in Italy? Who have you been consorting with when you've been with Naples, and what happens then? And of course there is the issue of drugs, and this is a riveting movie. I mean, as I say to Alex, he would know what's coming. If you don't know what's coming, it almost is like a thriller. It really is. It is first class from Capardia. He's an excellent documentary maker, but this really is a story where it's beneficial not to know some of these famous incidences. I know very little, obviously,
History, Richard. Now, somebody else who has also claimed she does very little about association football is Josephine Westlake. Probably far too much time spent in the geography field trips, I would have thought, but never mind. What are your thoughts? You're looking at the trailer, which gives me, it must be said, an awful lot of the story away. I'm sorry, but never mind. Would you be interested in Diego Maradona?
Not instinctively. No. I mean, with this film, is it, if you're not into football, is it still worth watching?
Well, yes, that's the point I was making was that Alex knew the details and I did not. But not knowing them makes this somewhat of a thriller because it's so extraordinary. Because this is not an ordinary career, and it's not just a question of his excellence and brilliance on pitch. It's his private life, which is dramatic enough, but also the really dramatic aspect of it and the way footballers... You know, as I say, if you play for Naples, but then Argentina, and then you're playing in Italy against your previous.
It's a challenging. It's country. A challenging sort of time, but
challenging time. But it's. I find it as a sort of a thriller. I was. It's rather like the fact of not reading a book before you see the film. You see the film, and the film, if whether or not it followed the book exactly, is of course the debate as to how faithful it should be. But it's just so. It riveted me.
Okay, Fergus, hypothetically, looking ahead, feeding forward here, next year's Journalism and Contemporary Cinema Group, do you think we should actually consider Diego Maradona as a possible sample to actually put out there? Would you see it yourself, or is it a case of no? He never played for Leicester City, therefore he doesn't exist.
No, I think it's a fascinating subject for a documentary because he's considered, even though he was kind of... Everyone talks about 1986, obviously the hand of God and the two goals he scored.
He doesn't talk about being the father-in-law of Sergio Aguero.
No,
of
he doesn't. And obviously his interest story with drugs, the famous incident in the USA World Cup, which I guess they talk about with the bulging eyes. And
oh, those bulging eyes.
I haven't dwelt on
exactly. Yeah.
it's an image that's
yes
kind
or
of
no, Fergus, would he be going to say this?
Yeah, I was going to say, because it's from the guy who made Senna, and that's a great documentary as well.
Oh, well, Senna's fantastic, and Senna really sweeps you up, and this is excellent too.
One Brazilian, one Argentinian, both sports people.
Yeah.
No, remarkable. I mean, it's so good that you get documentaries like this on general release, and I just hope it's seen by a lot of people. But, of course, Alex, you know the story, so... Would you be going yourself?
Oh, possibly. It depends on what sort of mood I'm in after England have beaten Norway tonight, really. That's the key thing, really.
I didn't know they were playing.
Yeah, exactly. Unbelievable. Let's move on to... I thought initially it was going to be another biopic. I thought it was going to be a tale of the actor from the Northeast, Jamie Bell. But I gather no, it's going to be Gloria Bell that we're actually looking for.
No, this is Gloria Bell, and it's directed by Sebastian Lelio, who's made the film in English of his earlier movie, which was foreign language. And it's very much a film for our times, the one Julianne Moore, I think, would be very proud of, because no doubt whatever that... It's what I loved about this film. I've seen so many, and I've been reviewing coming-of-age movies recently, and some comedies, some good, some not so good, but ones that you could so clearly see that there was a script. You know, you see, sometimes I watch scenes, and I see in my mind's eye there are screenwriters poring over it, you know, what would do, and then things had been replaced, and you have obvious stereotypes in that appear, the characters, and you have obvious parts of the plot which you can predict and so on. This is completely different. Gloria, played by Julianne Moore, is a middle-aged divorcee living in Los Angeles. She's got two children. Anne is a kind-hearted yoga instructor, and Peter is a married man who takes care of his daughter with his wife away, and she spends her nights, a lot of them, on the dance floor. She meets Arnold, played by John Turturro, an extremely fine actor. He's also a divorcee, and they hit it off. The trouble is, he supports his ex-wife and two daughters, and he owns a paintball arena. I wasn't familiar with what they are, but they do include those with rifle practice. And the moment I saw anyone with guns, I knew that the aspects of him were not going to come out particularly well, and indeed they don't. But she brings him to meet her family, and, well, he can't handle the closeness between her and her ex. Her daughter announces her pregnancy. She's moving to Sweden. Arnold is rather a pathetic figure, constantly on call for his daughters, but nonetheless, he takes Gloria to Las Vegas, and what happens there? Well, the plot continues. The facts are, however, it's not so much the drama of the plot which involves you, because the acting is so good. It's the fact that it's such a natural film that you feel that it isn't contrived, and this could really happen to real people, and that these are absolutely top-class actors, the top of their game. Julianne Moore...
Simply perfect.
You could say it's an ode, absolutely right, ode to feminism, indeed, finding yourself, independence, but nonetheless it's engrossing and involving, and it isn't clichéd. You don't have characters that you feel are being written.
Okay.
And you could, as I almost see this, Michael Cera as her son, very good. He is an excellent actress. And there's Joanne Triplehorn pops in too. So, I mean, a thoroughly satisfactory experience.
Jean Triplehorn, surely.
well scripted and good music.
There we are. Julianne and Jean. That's it. Jean Triplehorn, Julianne Moore. Impossible to do a bad movie with Julianne Moore, much like Keira Knightley. Will you be going to see Gloria Bell? Fergus.
It's not a film that I'd normally go and see at the cinema. If it comes on TV in a couple of years, I might check it out.
Okay.
I think this week my cinema viewing will be in the hands of Danny Boyle and Richard Curtis.
There you are. Yeah.
Oh, yes, I think it will, our cinema viewing.
Yesterday, a whole new world.
That. I haven't managed to see it as yet.
I'm sure you will, Richard, and equally we're sure that you won't be catching Toy Story 4, even though it'll make you cry because you don't do animated movies. That's okay. Wait until Disney do a live-action version of it in about 20 years' time, or maybe even less. Joe, will you be checking out Gloria Bell?
I don't think I will, but mainly because...
Can't stand Julianne Moore.
Well, being female and sort of coming up to that age,
yes.
I think it would be something that I'd go and see in about 10 years' time. nonetheless
will give you an insight, you know, into
what you're facing. Exactly what a challenge is in the air.
Instruction manual.
Well, it's a way forward. The dream
it's
has become.
It's an engrossing movie, and also, you know, you've got a good script, visually deft. So much to be said for it, and so lovely to see a film with Julianne Moore as, and Alex and I agree on this. There you have it. But of course, he slips Keira Knightley, and you see the very wicked.
I will conclude with John McKendrick, the Attorney General of Anguilla, and his views on the prospective next Prime Minister when he actually left his role as Foreign Secretary. Johnson.
May
is the...
I ask before you read them out whether you're. Interest in Boris Johnson has anything to do with the fact that I was quoted in the Mail about what might happen if he were to go to Balmoral in September if elected?
Well, you know, I was wondering whether you'd allude to that, but I'll let you share that with us in a few seconds after this little quote. Johnson is the worst Foreign Secretary we've ever had. Disinterested and out of his depth, he cared nothing for our situation. Good riddance. Surely when he goes to Balmoral, Richard, he'll show Her Majesty how to paint buses, miniature buses, but actually build those buses in a way that obviously only Boris can.
I have never heard anything like the rather extraordinary hobby to which you allude. It's rather like, I mean, this is extraordinary. What I said in the Mail, I was quoted by their political editor. The Queen is said to place great emphasis on precedent in dealing with such situations. The situation being referred to is when Boris comes to Balmoral, as prime ministers do, will he or will he not bring Kerry Simmons? But royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliam said, and I quote, under normal circumstances, I think the Queen would have ignored precedent and welcomed Boris and Kerry to Balmoral. Social morals have changed, and she would have been advised it was up to the prime minister to decide who to bring, particularly bearing in mind that Brexit is one of the biggest crises this nation has faced. But this incident changes that. Their relationship is clearly more volatile than anybody thought. Apart from breaking precedent, this would risk causing the Queen grave embarrassment. And I say to you, Alex, would you place a photograph in newspapers after the circumstances with the police being called, etc., which was, when was this taken? His hair was different.
The tragedy, Richard, as I said. And I'm speaking to somebody who will give Boris Johnson right of reply if he's listening to this as a podcast, as he might well be, who knows, he can come on the show, we're happy to speak to him about it, we spoke to his sister, obviously, back in the day. But ultimately, I just think, have we reached this stage in our Western culture where surely we should be capable of better if we're looking for somebody to actually take on board that particular mantle and you're getting that particular attitude, which is one of the reasons why I think Fergus was a bit shocked last night by the tirade of quotes I was actually parading out just in one small way to say, look, wake up, for goodness sakes, please. How far do we go down this particular line? But
well, the other point is the idea that seems to be coming up, I just couldn't believe that anyone mentioned this to begin with. Now, it does seem to be a thought that proroguing Parliament, that's very serious. And if you have an unwritten constitution, you play with it. Cameron played with it to a certain extent, but this is... But then what am I getting? I mean, it just...
Richard, breathe. When we raised this with Annette Andre last night and we talked about Donald Trump running for a second term, she was almost incandescent with rage, so we just have to ease back from that whole thing. Just breathe and remember, keep calm, listen to the Midweek Drive, and you'll get the Midweek Drive Morning Edition together with Richard Fitzwilliam's film reviews, and that'll keep you sane in some way, shape or form. Tomorrow, it's Care Home Friday. Joe, would you like to put those last two questions to Richard, please? You see, this is the test in terms of whether Fergus will actually help her or just say, no, just you're a scientist. You should actually know that you should ask him, has he had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat and is he coming back again? You know, what the hey?
Okay, so have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Oh, it's been terrific, and Alex has been on scorching form. Absolutely a trap every 5 minutes.
Whoa.
Oh, yes, indeed. And, of course, you know, you're... After an experience like Royal Ascot, I do feel buoyed up to face the next 52 weeks until we get it round again. But I agree with Alex. I mean, politically, we're really in bizarre times, and I think we'll remain in bizarre times for a long time to come.
And the next question?
So would you like to come back and join us again on the show?
Oh, yes, but then, I mean, yesterday will feature next week, I promise.
All our troubles seem so far away now. It looks as though they're here to stay. I believe in scrambled eggs.
something dark against the light. All I can say, it doesn't have to be this way. We'll be chasing our tails madly. See days pass like one.
Often been said that active mind is probably the best way to actually fight off and ward off challenges and a variety of other bits and pieces as we become more chronologically gifted. And with care homes across the country increasingly being under pressure, it's certainly critical that we start looking at how arts and culture can revolutionise activities within care homes. And we're delighted to actually speak to two fine folk to discuss this today. First of all, the Chief Executive Officer of Care England, Professor Martin Green, MBE. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
And the Executive Director at the National Activity Providers Association, that would be the wonderful Sylvie Silver. How are you, Sylvie?
Good morning. Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Sylvie, if we can come to you first, because, again, it seems almost a blindingly obvious statement that if you just sit fossilised and effectively not doing anything, not engaging, etc., then it's not going to actually be good for the overall health of one's mind or one's body.
Absolutely. And one of the things that care homes are getting better and better at is ensuring that people have that stimulation engagement that makes life worth living. And it's very, very important that we look at every individual and see what matters to them. And for some people, that might be appreciating art, looking at a picture. For somebody else, it might be doing a flower arrangement. Another person might take up drawing or painting. It doesn't have to be a big group event. It's just something that matters to that person.
And Martin, from your own perspective, the notion of how homes across the country are implementing these practices, and clearly we've had some negative publicity in recent years about, shall we say, improper healthcare and shoddy healthcare and so on. This is something which, as we head towards Care Home Open Day on Friday, people can actually see that actually there is good practice being employed.
Yeah, indeed. The majority of care homes provide a very good service for the people who live in them and also do some really wonderful things supporting their families as well. And I think Friday will be a real opportunity to see some great activities within care homes. And in fact, I was very interested in something that they're doing at the Grove Care Home in Waltham near Grimsby, where they're going to do an antiques roadshow event and also have a talk at 11:30 by Terry Dean around antiques. Now, those sorts of things are great for the residents. They're also great for families and also for the local community. So what we're going to see on Friday is a range of really good and very interesting things going on in care homes. So I would urge everybody to go onto the care home website, so carehomeopenday.org.uk, and see which care homes are open and what they're going to do on Friday, and go in and see for yourself the good quality care that is delivered day in, day out.
Sylvie, you've worked with and trained hundreds of care staff from senior management to grassroots workers. Do you see a gradual improvement, a kind of upward trend when it comes to caring for our more chronologically gifted or experientially enhanced citizens?
Absolutely. 15 years I've been working in the field of running the charity, and I did the job for 7 years myself. And the difference now is quite extraordinary. There's a huge recognition by the regulator, by care home providers and owners, that there is more to life than looking at the carpet. And they are all working very hard to try and make sure that that engagement is there for folk. It's a challenging thing to do when you've got a very frail, very dependent client group. People living with dementia can be difficult to engage. But when you start using the arts and the culture to stimulate people to grow their interest, care becomes wonderful. And it's wonderful for the residents, for the staff, for the families.
It's possibly also worthwhile noting that actually it's not one size fits all, that people do have different needs. There needs to be almost a bespoke approach, presumably, Martin, to ensure that individuals are looked at, as opposed to saying, well, so-and-so likes Picasso, so you should too.
Yeah, definitely. I think we have to be really personalised in this. And one thing that that you do notice is everybody's different, and our responses to that should be different. So there are some people who will absolutely love to hear some types of music and other people who would hate them. So you've got to really understand the person, know what their interests are, and work to support them to maintain those interests and activities when they go into a care home.
And clearly you raised the issue about the Antiques Roadshow and the aspect from that point of view, obviously triggering memories and so on. But what about creative activities and actually new memories? Is that something which has been seen to have efficacious positive effects on individuals by creating their own artistic works?
Yeah, absolutely, wonderfully. I was only talking yesterday about a lady in a care home in Kingston who had never done any kind of artwork in her life, has discovered watercolour painting and said to me that she paints every couple of days and it's the highlight of her day. It brings her satisfaction. Quite a severely disabled lady, physically very challenged, but she gets lost and absorbed in what she's doing. But she'd never done it before and she's in her 90s.
We mentioned, obviously, Care Home Open Day 2019. In terms of details, would you like to just share with us once again the best place to go to find out further details, please, Martin?
Yeah, if you go to the website, which is carehomeopenday.org.uk, you will see a full and comprehensive list of care homes that are open in your area and some of the things that they're doing. So I really hope that people will go on the website, and I hope that on Friday they will go into their local care home, connect with the residents and realise what does go on in care homes. I think one of the things that people don't really know is what goes on in care homes. Well, Friday is a great opportunity to find out.
Professor Martin Green, MBE, and Sylvie Silver, Executive Director at Charity National Activity Providers Association. I'm sure it's only a matter of time, Sylvie, before you get an MBE as well. I mean, we'll get that sorted through.
Thank you.
Many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.
Bye.
Dedicated to all those wonderful Newcastle United fans who clearly appreciate that Rafa's off to China. And Mike Ashley's a happy bunny. And I'm sure there's still a role for Sam Allardyce to return. Yay, Ian Lennox, I bet you're a happy bunny today.
Certainly am, yes.
Exactly. Last night we had our wonderful cosplay expert, Gwyneth Griffiths, who joined us again, and it's fair to say that as a lesser Newcastle in charge of the Proud to Be Geek store, etc., I think it's fair to say, Fergus, she was a bit upset, really, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was a bit down about the whole thing. Yeah,
a bit down about the whole thing. A takeover that was there a few weeks ago, probably not. I mean, Ian, I noticed that you'd put up a Facebook post saying,
It's time for Ashley to go, why? Surely. I mean, he's just saving you money. He's just being cautious. You don't want to actually give Rafa loads of money to actually spend and then expect things to happen, do you?
No, he's only a world expert and Ashley doesn't know anything about football. Why? What could go wrong?
Yeah, so you could appoint Josephine Westlake as the next manager. Self-confessed, don't know anything about football, do you, Joe?
No, it'd be pissed.
Bless. Women's World Cup event taking place. Faye White, of course, will be joining us, all being well, at 9:30 to talk about her time with Arsenal and indeed England. Have you been following it, or is it a case of you still don't believe in women's football because it just shouldn't be, Ian?
Oh, no, I've believed in women's football for about 15 years. When I was in Canada, I saw the, I think it was the World Under-21 World Cup. Hmm. And I went to Edmonton to watch Brazil play somebody, and I saw a 16 or 17-year-old girl absolutely, completely dominate the game. She was called Mata, and she went on to become the world's best footballer, women's footballer. See, I think she's just about reaching retirement age now. She played in this World Cup. But more pertinently, you know, if you watch the viewing figures in England, I think the last game got 6.9 million viewings.
Excellent, I think, and it's going to get higher. I think it's fair to say I'd always seen the Brazilian footballers Marta, not Mata. But you know,
well, probably Marta, I'm sure it is.
It's a moot point, but she gave a very.
I think if you're supporting Castaneda, you avoid using the word Marta.
Look, appreciate it. Share the pain. I mean, look, it's 50 years since Bobby Moncur lifted the Fairs Cup, so you know that sort of basis. You know, you just give it some more. I heard a rumour that Kevin Keegan might be returning. Oh, sorry. It's just.
I don't think that there's such a thing as a credibility gap.
Yeah.
I think I were laughing actually, and some of my friends were talking about Benitez 3 years at Newcastle, I think it was. Mm. And we wondered how many times Kevin Keegan would have resigned if he'd been there for 3 years.
Exactly. But he would love it if a plan could come together. Love it. And we'll be talking about how many people actually use the L word incorrectly. Yes, Rachel Lloyd from eHarmony says that in Britain, we tend to, literally, in a relationship, be saying, I love you far too soon. You know, it's like it's become almost a matter of course, really. I mean, Joe, can you remember when was the first time? Or have you ever used it? I mean, has that ever come into you? As a scientist, you say, I don't believe in these emotional chemical activities that go on. It's just a different line.
Yeah, I don't. I try to avoid emotions.
Yeah, totally neutral, totally objective. Whoosh, sorted. Fergus? Bucking the trend, sir. Bucking the trend. Never mind. Ian,
yes.
World Cup tonight, Norway. Can we do it? Can we actually beat, I say we collectively in this basis, will, even with or without Steph Houghton, Tony Duggan and so on, will the Lionesses do the business?
Well, I hope so. They're ranked higher than Norway, but Norway apparently have got a very, very good young player. Most of the Norwegian sort of template for football is to have big athletic players, men and women. But this girl apparently has got a lot of skill and goes past people. And she almost scored a wonder goal against South Korea, I think.
Yeah.
She scored the first penalty in the shootout.
A little bit anxious. I'm bearing in mind it's Europe against the United States of America, it would seem, given that there are any Asian teams in. Wasn't it unfortunate? Did you see the game where those Japanese players trade so hard? They hit the bar, did all sorts of things, and then they lost to a pathetic penalty in the end of the day. It was just.
I didn't see the game, but I saw Japan play us. And I think they dominated us in the second half.
But we beat them 2-0, so that was the important thing. So
yes, we did. I don't think that was a deserved result at all. Anyway.
So it goes. That's the point.
Yes, it exactly. is.
And notice the way we seamlessly managed to sort of take away from the pain of Rafa leaving by actually sort of saying, look, there are other things to focus on and other important factors. I mean, we've had a very painful first 50-odd minutes in which the spectre of a blonde imbecile taking over in Parliament as our Prime Minister has been regularly raised. I didn't mention any names, but I think it's fair to say we're sort of, you know, it's what's happening. So elected in a fully democratic way, in the same way that he was very supportive of how Gordon Brown actually became Prime Minister, so it's nice
to
see.
Well, I'm sure he was getting the same way.
There you have it. You know, that's it. But as a little treat for yourself, Ian, I felt it was only right for us to bring out some Mark Knopfler to actually take us up to the news, after which we'll be looking at pop-up phobia, the fact that people are actually finding a scenario whereby we just, you know, we're afraid of pop-ups. We are irritated by pop-ups. They keep sort of inert. They were talking about web surfing and various other bits and pieces. Whilst I sort out this Mark Knopfler thing, who would you like to ask you those last two questions? Would it be our geographer Joe, or would it be our film fledgling Fergus? Geographer Joe.
Phil Fledging Fergus.
Fergus, you're just so Mr. Popular this week. Yeah, unbelievable.
I've taken up the spot of somebody else.
Clearly, so. Clearly, exactly. Anyway, off you go, please.
So, Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Short but sweet.
Mm. And we'll be joining us again next week.
I hope so.
That's all we can ask for, really, ultimately. Health, Wealth and Ian Lennox joining us on the programme is pretty much at the heart of our key sort of elements that that we'd like to actually work through on that basis. And I think we appreciate that. That's the important thing. Mark Knopfler, a little tune I don't think you've ever recommended for us before, but I feel it's for Rafa fans everywhere. Why I Man. Happy trails, Ian. Auf Wiedersehen. See you next week.
We had no way staying afloat. We had to leave on a ferry boat. Economic refugees on the run to Germany. We had the back of Maggie's hand. Times were tough in Geordie land. Got our tools and work and gear and humped it all from Newcastle to here. Why I man? Why I? Why I man? 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 Traveling boys, in the dust and dirt and the racking noise, drills and hammers, diggers and picks, mixing concrete, laying bricks. There's English, Irish, Scots, the lot. United Nations, what we've got. Brickies, chippies, every trade, German building, British made.
Today in Lincoln. Highs of 19 degrees centigrade, lows of 10 degrees centigrade a day of sunny intervals with a moderate breeze. And nothing's popped up to actually tell us otherwise. But it does seem that when we talk about pop-ups on computers, we say, no, let's just get away from pop-ups. I mean, I think it's fair to say from your background as postgraduate science specialist, Josephine, you're also sort of, you don't like pop-ups, do you?
I do not, no, I hate them. You're trying to do work, you're trying to do research, and every time you click on something...
Something else pops up?
Yeah.
Fergus, are you a pop-up phobe?
Yeah, because I mean, it's like whenever you've clicked on something and then it leads to another page, it's almost like a panic.
Well, the key question is pop-up phobia putting our digital lives at risk? And we have two fabulous folk to actually talk about this phenomena. First of all, tech psychologist extraordinaire Dr. Mark Neath. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning to you.
And consumer security expert from Avast, Stephanie Kane. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Excellent. Mark, if we can come to you first. I mean, you've just heard from two of our postgraduate students here at the University of Lincoln, home of Siren Radio. Is this something which you think, yeah, that's fine, we hate pop-ups, but what about that one pop-up that your computer needs, otherwise disaster could ensue?
And that is exactly the issue. But this is, there are lots of things in life that we know we should do, but we don't. And what you've just heard from your two guests that you've got there are the two reasons why we often don't do this. One of them is a panic reaction, and one of them is just it's just not rewarding to do. So we need to quite radically, I think, rethink the way that we think about this. Because, yeah, I speak as somebody who lost my PhD 2 years into it.
Oh.
I lost it all. I mean, I'd only written 2 pages, so it wasn't terrible. But
you know, you've got 120,000 words potentially, and if the whole thing goes, whoa.
I would cry.
Well, I did more than cry, I can tell you. So the threat is very real.
Mm. I mean, Stephanie, is that something which, again, you know, from the point of view of security, Mark's experience there, we obviously see 2 pages going, but it could be 2 pages, could be 20,000 pages. I mean, a similar sort of area, if those things aren't backed up and you've got sort of viruses that impact, problems can occur.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark's example, I think, probably resonates with a lot of us. I didn't lose a PhD myself, but certainly I have lost photos and things in the past. Mm. So it's something which I think when you realise the implications of not being secure and then being attacked by some kind of malware, you realise that actually what you're losing is something which means a lot to you personally. And we actually asked some consumers if they felt that pop-ups put them off taking this good security hygiene measures, and 47% said that pop-ups were met with feelings of impatience, irritation and apprehension. And I think we can all say that that's how we feel about them. But nonetheless, even though they're annoying, they're there to prompt us into action. And there's a really good reason for doing that.
OK, Mark, let's talk about the psychology of technology and so on. I mean, we love technology, or many of us like technology. We like it for the ease that it brings us and so on. I mean, I'm coming to terms with one of my computer systems that I still tend to use is a sort of Windows 7, and I've been doing all the updates, but now I'm told that January 2020, Microsoft will stop supporting that, so get it sorted, effectively. How do you cope with respect to that? And is it a case of that built-in obsolescence that somehow, you know, again, probably leads to people saying, oh, well, why bother? They're just going to replace it in a few years in any case.
Yeah, and I think that's a big attitude change. We sometimes buy a piece of equipment, and you know, a computer or a laptop could be relatively expensive. And once we've bought it, we think, right, I've got that now, that's it. And it's a bit like having a car in that regard. You know that your car is only going to last so long, and probably your car these days will last longer than your laptop will. So there's an attitude change, and we've got to get used, I think, to making an investment every few years in the actual kit itself. Otherwise, things do become obsolescent, and that's just a natural way of things. And if we don't get used to that natural way of things, it just becomes, yeah, we do treat it like it's an irritation, but that it's... Yeah, so we need to change our mindset, I think, in terms of that.
Stephanie, is it a bit like knowing you need to actually brush your teeth morning and night if you want to actually ensure that you've got good dental hygiene? And if you don't do that, you've got problems. Could we use that analogy in terms of keeping your software up to date and so on?
I think that's fair. I also think that it's important to understand that although you're talking about your own individual devices, ultimately your devices is connected to the internet, and once it joins that, it's part of a much bigger global network. And that's where the real risk comes in, because you have a responsibility to look after your devices, not just for your own security, but also for that of anyone else on the internet. And a good example of that is the WannaCry ransomware that hit about 2 years ago. You'll probably remember that, because it actually took the NHS down. Mm. How that travelled was simply a vulnerability that was exploited by some bad guys. And because there was unpatched PCs on the NHS network, once one got infected, it just transmitted to the rest. So it's not just about thinking, oh, I can't be bothered, or I'll do it later. It's interrupting what I'm doing right now. It's actually saying, well, you need to make time for this. Put it in your diary, once a month, check, whatever it is, because actually the implications are not just about impacting your devices, but other people's as well.
Joe, questions, thoughts?
The one pop-up that gets me is the new GDPR requirements. So every time you go onto a website...
But it's the law. That General Data Protection Act.
But it comes up every time you go onto a website, and the first thing that comes up is that, and you have to click on the little cross, and you have to find the little cross, and it's irritating. So that's one of the things I was going to mention. But the other thing I was going to say is that pop-ups are great in terms of security and stuff, but what about the people who are visually impaired who are using the internet? It's kind of forgotten that they actually use the internet, really. And they use screen readers, they use magnification things, and it's actually very difficult for them to identify where these pop-ups are. Half the time they can't even find them, and it takes a really long time for them to deal with them compared to everybody else.
Stephanie, would you like to take that one?
Sure. So on the GDPR one, first of all, I think that is interesting. I mean, absolutely, it's part of the law. So websites are mandated to get your permission to collect your data, because when you go online, they track you by putting a cookie on your browser, so they know who you are and what you visited. It helps them understand what was interesting, what was not interesting, how to do better content for their users, etc. So it has a purpose. There's also a marketing purpose for tracking that kind of data. So you have to give consent. And what's interesting about this is it's an annoying pop-up, but actually it's designed to make us think, to prompt us to think about whether we want to share that information about ourselves or not. So we weigh up whether the risk is worth taking. Do we want to share our personal data so we can get the content we're trying to access? Or do we actually want to think twice and say no? That's not going to change, because we're now in an age where privacy is actually really important. Mm. And it's good to have this kind of prompt in a way that doesn't go away and you're forced to make that choice in split second. It is irritating, but it's for your own good, really.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. Is there not a way, like you can do on a lot of websites and things, where you can sort of pre-select it? So, for example, I just want to click no on everything. Can you not set it so that we can do that?
Yeah, it's different with GDPR, because every single entity has to have consent to take your data. Cookies are different because once cookies on your system, it recognises it, and you can set all your cookies to accept all, so it doesn't matter where you are. But with GDPR, it's actually opt-in, so unfortunately it's mandatory as part of the law.
Otherwise, who knows what misinformation and data scenarios could be going through there. Fergus, your thoughts from yourself?
Well, with the issue with pop-ups, you see them when you're on any website. How do people go about deciding what's a good pop-up, what's a bad pop-up, which is going to help you and which is going to crash your computer?
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. Mark, that's an interesting one, because some pop-ups are malevolent pop-ups, and you don't want to actually... So, Mark, what is the psychology behind that?
So that's it, and we're not sure. So part of Stephanie might have a technical response to that. My thing is a lot of us are kind of learning this stuff. For a lot of us, this is a kind of second language kind of thing. So if part of that is just taking the fear out of it. If we don't know what to do, that's because we're feeling anxious about something, and the quickest way to alleviate that fear is just to ignore it or to close it, which isn't great. Part of this is just educating yourself about it. Mm. And so that's just generally good advice, is take the fear out of it. Talk to somebody who knows about these things. But Stephanie, you'd have a view on some of those pop-ups that would be notifications, at least, that are safer than others, I think.
Definitely, and I think it's a really good question, because one thing we're seeing in this quite sophisticated technology age is that people are usually the weakest link in security, and that's where a lot of the bad guys are actually formulating malware that can trick people into downloading it. So you're probably aware of phishing sites where you can accidentally put in your details thinking it's your genuine bank, or it's an email that's clicking you through to a link that's genuine. And it's very easy done, and it is designed to trick you. So it doesn't mean that you're stupid if you fall for it. It means that they have done a very good job at tapping into your psychology and making you take an action that's harmful, while all the way thinking that actually it was fine. So there's a couple of things we always recommend. First of all, were you expecting to get that email is a really good one. If you could pop up on your screen saying, your account is under attack, or we're going to lock it, please click here to confirm your password, etc. If it seems strange and out of the blue and you're not aware anything else is wrong, then don't click on the link. Instead, if it's from a certain company, like your bank, for example, go to their website directly and check and see if they have any alerts up there or any information. Log into your account on a separate browser, not through the link, and check and see if there's any messages for you. If everything looks okay, it's a scam. So that's one thing we recommend. Secondly, if you're on YouTube, for example, and you're watching a video and you get a pop-up saying, oh, you need to update this software to be able to do the video properly, click here to do that. Never do that, because usually that's some kind of scam. And you should instead, if you think that your Java or whatever it is out of date, go again onto the official site and download the update. But it'll tell you if you need to update or not. But never click on random pop-ups telling you that, because chances are they're not good. And then finally, just take a wee look at how it's been written. So if you think the language is a bit weird, or some spelling mistakes, or a friend has emailed you and they've asked you for something very strange, or they've talked to you in a way that wouldn't be normal for them, then again, just think twice and check with that friend and say, did you ask me to do this? I'm just checking, it seemed a bit strange. And then you'll get the answer. But unfortunately, in this day and age, vigilance is all that you need. You just have to think twice before you do anything.
Stephanie Kane, consumer security expert for Avast, not Avast Me Hearties, I just say the pirate radio thing coming across there. Avast.com, presumably, would be the best place to go,
that's
Stephanie,
right,
to work through various other bits and pieces. And Dr. Mark Neath, tech psychologist extraordinaire, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
from someone who definitely has the music in them and actually would probably go by the metaphor of You Get What You Give, is the founder of The Healthy Mummy and best-selling author extraordinaire. It's Rhiann Allen. Good morning, Rhiann. How are we?
Good morning, I'm well. How are you?
Excellent. It's now this particular thing, the Healthy Mummy Survey. Mums are the key person of influence for the health and longevity of their families, but they lack time and motivation. We have a mum in the studio who's doing her PhD at the University of Lincoln. That's Josephine Westlake. Josephine, you saw this story. Did it resonate with you?
Absolutely. I've joined the gym recently, and it is really hard to find the time and motivate yourself to go when you've got so much else going on.
So, Rhiann, clearly Jo is in need of your assistance here. How can the Healthy Mummy effectively give Jo the willpower to succeed and move forward for health and longevity for her family? I mean, her children want her to. Her mum, it's all... how does it work, Rhiann?
Well, I think that you always have to start with small steps, because when you become a mum, as Josephine will know, everything changes. Your priorities, your time, your motivation, your budget, and also your support network. So I think it's really important to have a good support network. If you don't have close family and friends who can do that, we've got amazing support networks with Healthy Mummy UK. Also, just starting small, because going to the gym, it is difficult. I think it's difficult if you don't have kids. But if you have kids and you're not sleeping, it's even harder, right? So one of the things we kind of advocate and advise is to just do 10 little minutes of intervals during the day of exercise, which is more doable from a mental perspective and from a physical perspective, rather than trying to slog it out in the gym. And then just making small steps, small swaps with food, but just starting small so it's not overwhelming.
I was astounded to find that over half of UK mums put things like going on nice holidays, being rich and looking good above their health. Surely being rich and looking good, you have all the wealth in the world. If you don't have your health, disaster. And likewise, you're not necessarily going to look good if your sort of health's all to pot, really. But just a thought there. And Fergus, any thoughts from yourself?
Well, I was kind of surprised. Yeah, that statistic kind of came out to me as well. Like the
I mean, is that just a typical male perspective we just don't understand, Rhiann? Is that
I think, to be fair, it's hard for men to really understand what it's like to be a mum, because it is really hard. But I think that the survey kind of shows that, because, you know, a lot of us have been warped by the idea of healthy eating or living, you know, from really bad messages through weight loss companies over decades. And I think we all think it's too hard. We all think we need to exercise for an hour a day. We all think we need to eat under 1,000 calories. So I think mentally we all think it's too hard. So they go, everyone will go, I'd rather go on a nice holiday or be rich or whatever, because they think it's the alternative's too hard.
Now, we've talked in the past, Josephine, about your wonderful partner, which is great. Give him a shout out, I think, on the first show, 7-8 years or thereabouts. Is he supportive?
No.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. We won't name and shame.
I've
but,
tried to get him to come to the gym with me, and he won't come. He just doesn't do the gym. I mean, he helps out, so he'll take some of the stress away. I think that's one of the big things on here as well, is the idea of mental health. It says at the top about... 72% of the country's mums do not feel healthy, and over half of them suffer from depression or something similar all the time. And I would suggest that almost all of them suffer from it, you know, several times a year, I would think. It's very hard to watch out for your health if you don't feel like getting out of bed in the morning. That is the really tough part, I think.
Rhiann, again, a typical scenario?
Scenario, and I think that partners, friends and family who are not in the position of you, of you the mum, who is extremely tired, it's hard for them to really understand. And I think that, you know, what every mum needs to do is really talk to their partner and explain how they're feeling, because mental health is a huge issue, not just for mums, but the whole population, and we need to talk about it. And I think it's really important to say to your partner, look, I need your support because I'm so exhausted, I can barely get out of bed, but I have to, and I need your support. So it's not helpful if you come home with a huge bag of dairy milk, and it's not helpful if you order takeaway every night, and it's not helpful if you don't encourage me to be healthy. They need to understand that, you know, healthy living and lifestyle is more than just physical appearance. It's about mental health and inner well-being as well.
Well, I think that's wonderful. Although I'd probably point out that, as far as I'm aware, Joe, I don't think you normally actually bring home a whole bag of dairy milk. Oh, maybe you do. I don't know. It's just a thought, you know.
No, I think it's my husband. My husband does tend to do that sort of stuff.
There you go.
And yeah, it is easy. You want somebody to sort of, you go, oh, should we get a takeaway? You need them to turn around and go, yeah. No. Mm. No, that's what you actually need. It is very difficult if you don't have somebody doing that. And I've switched my diet recently, so I've been trying to eat more healthily. Eating less meat and things like that, he won't do it. So it means I'm cooking different meals all the time, which is just puts me off cooking.
Well, Josephine, can I just say you need to check out the Healthy Mummy because all of our food is family friendly and husband friendly. And one of the biggest feedbacks we get is blokes who normally say, oh, I'm not going to eat that because I'm not eating a diet food. They don't even know that the food is healthy. It's healthy versions of good, you know, hearty, family-friendly food, and that's one of the reasons that so many mums do actually like the Healthy Mummy.
Well, that makes sense, of course, and it's not all kale, obviously.
No, there's no kale!
That's, you know, it can be one of those sort of challenges where you sort of think, where's that going to from that point of view? And from your own perspective, Rhiann, where do you think that most mums would actually benefit from a little extra help? I mean, we've had a bit of a case study with Joe this morning. Are there any other general areas where you think, actually, you know, these are the kind of things that need to be worked on?
Meal planning. I think that, as Josephine mentioned, you know, you're really tired. And if you can sort your food out in the evenings when you go home and you're cooking well, it makes a big difference. And one of the things that I'm an enormous advocate of is meal prep. So you spend an hour, possibly an hour and a half in the kitchen on a Sunday, get your kids involved, and you can meal prep your food for the week. So when you come home, it's already cooked. You don't have to worry about the lure of a takeaway or not making healthy food. I think meals is definitely the biggest area that I think most mums would say, yes, that's where it's going to make a difference in my life if I can get dinner for the whole family made healthily and on a budget.
Certainly works for me. Thehealthymummy.co.uk, nothing to do with Egyptian hieroglyphics or indeed sort of ancient horror movies. So just, you know, a healthy mummy as in what it certainly means to be the healthy mummy.co.uk. Rhiann, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self. Have you had a reasonably interesting and healthy telephonic link with us on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition yourself this morning?
Loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
So the next critical question is, will you be kind enough to return in the not-too-distant future?
Of course.
Yay!
Came in town with a pocket full of songs. I made the rounds, but I didn't last long. Now I'm out on this highway with a bone cold chill. Somewhere north of Nashville, I lie awake in the middle of the night, making a list of things that I didn't do right. With you at the top of a long page field, here somewhere north of Nashville. For the deal I made, the price was strong. I traded you for this song. We woke each morning with hearts filled, a bluebird of love on the windowsill. Now the heart's unsteady and the night is still. All I got's this melody and time to kill. Here's somewhere north of Nashville. Here's somewhere north of It's somewhere north of Nashville.
Somewhere north of Nashville, Bruce Springsteen. Sometimes our co-presenters will realise when the microphone goes live, they need to shh. Otherwise, it gets very confusing in all sorts of ways. Coming up in a few moments, we'll be talking All Being Well to the awesomely wonderful Faye White. Again, a legend, certainly to Arsenal fans over the years, and indeed to women footballers across the globe, as, of course, we continue our build-up to the awesome quarter-final. Yeah, the quarter-final between England and Norway later on today. Now, it does seem as though the B word is continually feeding its way into our consciousness, and we can't get away with it even if we wanted to, really, with recent research suggesting that the United States of America is indeed the preferred trading partner in a post-Brexit world. Almost half of small and medium-sized UK businesses saying they would prefer to do business with America after Britain leaves the EU. And to talk about this and maybe provide some useful information as well to the whole debate, we're delighted to welcome the Vice President of Payments Products for Western Union UK. That's the wonderful Karen Penny. How are you, Karen?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. So this particular report, the H1 Barometer report, says kind of possibly might have already deduced this in any case, that the preferred choice of trading for people in the UK is the United States, despite obviously presidential issues and so on.
Absolutely, yes. Our survey found that a number of companies in the UK are looking towards the US, and the US is already our number two trading partner after the EU. So I guess that's probably based on our traditional historic relationship with the US. But we are still going to be doing business, obviously, with Europe. And many of the respondents are actually also looking further afield. They're looking towards the East, in particular India and China, where they're looking for price competitive products and services.
Have the Commonwealth countries effectively dropped out of the market for this thing? Because I seem to recall a few years ago people saying, well, it's all right, we won't worry about the European Union because clearly we've got the Commonwealth to actually support us. They don't seem to be mentioned so often these days.
Well, they are mentioned. I guess companies are looking for trading partners globally. They're looking to strengthen their supply chain and find competitively priced goods, and they'll do that wherever they can. And about a quarter of the people that we surveyed said actually they were going to look at Brazil, not in the Commonwealth, but the 1 in 10 actually mentioned Nigeria and Ghana also.
So Canada and Australia, I was thinking again, possibly one of the reasons with the United States might be the commonality of English, but that's not really a factor in terms of the business scenario, it would seem.
Canada did get a mention, Australia less so, but I guess companies are looking, as I said, outside of the EU to find businesses that they can work easily with and that they can get price competitive products and services from.
The other acronym I seem to recall a few years ago was very much the BRIC economy, Brazil, Russia, India and China. We talked about obviously India and China, and you mentioned briefly Brazil. Russia, is that a whole new ball game these days?
Well, companies are looking for good trading partners, and I guess they have to prepare themselves for the risks that come with whoever they trade with. And what we found was that while most of the companies we spoke to were very au fait with the fluctuations of the pound against the euro, once they started to look further afield, they had much less information and much less knowledge, which then opens them up to more risk. And as the currencies fluctuate against each other, if the rates go against you and you end up paying more for the products and services than you expected, then clearly that can have a risky effect on your business.
Well, you mentioned not only the C word there, but the F word, currency fluctuation, of course, and the fluctuations between sterling and the euro, mostly understood by most businesses. But when it comes to the pound and the Japanese yen or the Indian rupee, not necessarily the same level of understanding exists, really.
No, and that's where companies really need to find good partners to work with. So companies like Western Union, who can give them information, who can give them insights. And if you have a look, for example, at the business.westernunion.com website, there's lots of information there that companies can get for free to help them put in place the right FX strategy.
Well, that sounds ideal. But if we're looking to give some advice, Karen, to small businesses who may be worried about their post-Brexit options and don't want to simply adopt the policy of an ostrich and stick their heads in the metaphorical sand, what would you suggest they should be thinking about?
Well, first of all, I think they should plan. So they should get as much information as they can. They should find themselves a trusted partner. And they should look for a platform where they can get information and trade for themselves online. Once they've got that plan in place, though, they really need to review it regularly because, as we know, the situation changes on a daily basis. If there's a throwaway comment by Boris Johnson or an...
That's not going to happen, is it, surely? I mean, you know, he's so on message, it's unbelievable.
Well, you have to prepare for every eventuality, yeah. Don't you?
Well, certainly that. I mean, who would have thought a few years ago that we'd have two blondes on either side of the Atlantic? But still, that's a different line entirely. Still, and not in any pejorative sense of the word. But so let's not go there, Carrie. Let's just breathe and carry on. Let's remind folk of the Western Union address in terms of the website. Where's the best place to go to for further information?
So the best place for more information is business.westernunion.com.
Karen Penny, Vice President of Payments Products for Western Union. Many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I think it's bad news for the English game. We're not creative enough and we're not positive enough.
It's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming. Football's coming home.
We'll go on getting back. It's on getting back. It's on getting back. It's on getting back.
It's coming. Football's coming home. It's coming. So sure that England's gonna throw it away, gonna blow it away, but I know they can play, 'cause I remember three lines on the shirt, Jules Rimet still gleaming, 30 years of hurt, never stop me dreaming.
So many jokes, so
see that tackle by Moore, and when Lineker scored, Bobby Belt in the ball.
And in a couple of weeks' time, we'll hear the tackle by Steph Houghton and the goal by Tony Duggan and all sorts of wonderful things, because, yes, fingers crossed, we'll beat Norway and we'll continue ever onwards. And who better to actually talk about our progress in the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup than basically a legend in so many ways. We followed her through in her time at Arsenal, at England, etc. It's the awesomely talented Faye White. How are you, Faye?
Good morning, I'm very well, are you?
Excellent. There was one thing about your career, Faye, which I just think, sadly, you never played for my own side, Manchester City. But never mind. That, yeah, I'm sure we could get something sorted out on that basis. What the hey? You know, clearly Arsenal through and through, and rightly so. Faye, it's going quite well, but we don't want to kind of jinx it at this stage, do we? I mean, Norway, we were talking about them earlier with a few correspondents. They got one or two tasty players this evening.
See, we want England to do well, don't we? But yeah, Norway will be a tougher test than what we've currently seen in the, you know, in the group phase and that game against Cameroon. Obviously, that brought up some issues in itself. But Norway is much more technically and tactically astute in their play.
Yes, I won't get started on what happened to Steph Houghton in the Cameroon game, because that was just very unfortunate. And I think it's fair to say that actually, from your own point of view, Faye, actually holding your nerve. I mean, one of the things I've always said about women's football in general is that the standard of behaviour is usually far better than the men's. And yet Cameroon didn't quite keep that standard going, did they, really?
Well, I think sometimes when teams at a lower rank come up against the better teams, they have to look at ways that they're going to try and, you know, disrupt them and what have you. And obviously Cameroon are a physical team anyway. Mm. But no, generally in the women's game, you don't see much rolling around or dissent towards the referee. So that was very much emotion and situation which we haven't seen from teams normally. But obviously Cameroon are quite well known for their passion and what have you, but... Yeah, this game and the games you'll see now going forward will be of high level now we get into the crunch stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, a part of things that we've got in the studio, Josephine Westlake. Joe, fair to say, no interest in football. And yet, when we heard the three lines coming out there, you said that was the time which took you back, did it not?
It did, yeah. 1996 was the one year that I actually really listened to football. And I used to watch the Skinner and Badil thing every week. Bought an England shirt, everything. It's absolutely...
So we got to the semi-finals then. This is a chance for us to again get to the semi-finals and move on from that point of view. How can Green King and Faye White in particular persuade you, Joe, to actually support the Lionesses tonight?
I have no idea. Literally, I've just lost all interest in
Faye,
football.
Faye, we've got a lost soul here. How can we help Joe get back on the bandwagon?
Oh, you come on, you've got to be involved. These girls, I know how hard they work and what they've sacrificed over their careers to know that people will be coming together, like you said, with drinking and having 1,000 pubs that are going to allow everyone to come out as a community and support the game. It will give the girls so much belief and confidence and, you know, extra drive to do well, because they really know that they are promoting the game and trying to get inspire more young girls to take up sport, not only just for enjoyment but for health reasons as well. So when they go and represent their country, they really are putting their hearts on their sleeves and you know, wanting to do well and be role models for young girls to give them options going forward.
As you yourself did, Faye, over 90 times, well, certainly 90 times for England. And did you ever feel you wanted to go that extra 10, you know, just get up to 100? I mean, it was always that tempt to say, oh, I'll just go up to 100. You think, no, 90 was fine.
No, I wish I could have. I think a few injuries stopped me from getting those few extra. But obviously, I had a great career, a long career. During a time where we had to change, you know, the perceptions of the game. But it's certainly got there now, and it's great to see the England doing so well.
And indeed, obviously, as you're now developing a whole new career as a top-quality commentator, so I think it's worthwhile just tuning in from that point of view. Fergus, Leicester City supporter, I know. Any thoughts that you'd like to share with Faye, or any questions?
So, Faye, what's your reaction been to how the country's embraced the England women's team? Because I think there was the game against Scotland,
they're much more successful than the England cricket team, let's face it,
and the Cameroon game, I think, set broadcast records for the BBC. So how have you felt seeing the whole country just get behind England, especially the women's team, the way they got behind the men's team?
Yeah, no, it's been amazing, you know, to see those records keep getting broken. The first game was 6 million, then it's nearly 7 million, you know, viewing on the telly, and the kind of media coverage it's getting, and seeing young girls and boys wearing, you know, shirts with Horton and Paris on the back nowadays as well. It's just great, and it's showing, like, the appetite that is out there for the women's game and women's sport in general. So more may it continue, and obviously we always knew when we were playing for our country that success is going to help that along the way even more. So they'll know that, and that's what will be driving them on to tonight against Norway.
It's very much against the USA against the world here, or the USA against Europe, shall we say, because obviously, I thought it was very sad, actually, the way that Japan actually bowed out. I mean, I know England beat them 2-0, but I did feel that they were very unlucky. I mean, just very quickly, Faye, that penalty, I mean, there must have been a time where, honestly, I know VAR was actually there, but was it something which you would have said, that's a bit harsh to have a penalty given for that instance?
Yeah, I think that's where obviously the rule changed, where it used to be ball to hand or hand to ball, you know, that would, whether it was intentional or not, and that's obviously been dropped, and any kind of contact now is viewed as a handball, and it is quite hard for a defender because it's quite an unnatural movement to defend with your hands behind your back. So it's something I think defenders are going to have to learn now going forward. But the way the Japan team played in that second half against the Netherlands, you did think they deserved it. They hit the bar. Some of the skill and the possession that they had was brilliant. And, you know, they were, this time round, they were on the end of, you know, a harsh decision. But it was a handball with the new laws. But going back to 4 years ago, England were kind of similar situation, played Japan in the semi-final of the World Cup in Canada, and it lost to a very freak own goal by Laura Bassett, which I think if we repeated 1,000 times, it wouldn't happen again.
Absolutely.
So England have felt that, you know, it's a slightly different situation and what have you that put England out that time, but this time Japan on that penalty. And we've seen that a lot, haven't we, with the Scotland game as well and the retakes of penalties and things like that when they went out as well. So it's something which VAR is bringing into the game, but equally at the end of the day, it is showing that the decisions are getting right and they're not being missed by the referee, which has happened in previous World Cups.
Faye, we could talk for an awful long time about a whole range of things, etc. I'm going to say 2-0 to England tonight. I'm going to believe in that routine. Dare you actually risk a prediction from your own point of view?
I would be looking at 2-1, think, again.
Okay.
So, yeah, because Norway, they're not, you know, they do concede goals, but equally they can score goals too. So 2-1 for England.
We'll also mention greenking.co.uk, which is worthwhile going to find out further details and various other bits and pieces. Faye, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic debut on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition? Has it been good for you?
Yes, definitely.
Good.
Yeah, very good.
Can we look forward to connecting with you again in the near future?
Yes.
Yay! A round of applause.
Did we get to further rounds?
Yeah, a round of applause for Faye White, please. Yay! England's finest. Now, it would seem that in an era where clearly communication is very much at the heart of what we as human beings need to actually be aware of and sort of focused on in so many ways, that there are three words that effectively can be very problematic. Je t'aime, ich liebe dich. I love you. Oh no, when is the right time to say those three little words? Well, a research from eHarmony reveals 1 in 10 lovesick Brits have actually dropped this within 7 days of meeting them. In fact, as a nation, we tend to declare our love with less than 4 months on average going on around 108 days. Too soon? Marry in haste? Repent at leisure? Who knows? Best person to actually seek advice as far as this is concerned and talk about the research is indeed the awesome relationship expert from eHarmony, the fantastic Rachel Lloyd. How are you, Rachel?
Morning. I'm feeling very loving this morning.
Oh, exactly. I'm not going to say those three words. It was too soon. Too soon. We just
too
need to...
Exactly.
I think so. I think we need to let the whole thing breathe and develop on that basis. But it does it kind of reveal something about us as a society that we're prone to actually sort of say, I love you? Or do we actually, in a sense, have we kind of... started losing the meaning of the phrase, so we tend to it's lost its value because of the amount of time we actually say it.
Well, there is something in that. I mean, the fact that 1 in 10 Brits say I love you within a week, I would suggest that that might not be about love. That's about high intensity. It's about chemistry, especially as a lot of people tend to say it in the bedroom or in the pub. So, you know, for the first time. So
there's nothing worse than when you have a somewhat inebriated journalist saying, I've always loved you. I've loved you ever since the first time I saw a microphone above the whole thing. It's not going to help. Alcohol doesn't help with these things.
Indeed. On the other hand, I would say that I love you has become a more common phrase, if you like. I think that we are far more liberal with it. And that compares to sort of older generations who I think were far more reserved about it. Now, my parents, who are, shall we call them silver surfers? Let's call them that. Not old people. They said that when they were growing up, they rarely ever heard the three magic words, I love you, from their parents or friends. It was just something that was a bit sort of sentimental and embarrassing. And so they made a point when they raised their children to be much more open with the I love yous. And I think what's happened is as generations have progressed, millennials, you know, and even younger people are now able to confidently say I love you far more often. But of course, there is a danger that some people may be overusing it, sort of pass the milk, I love you. But I love you, I love you. You know, it can become almost an everyday phrase.
Well, certainly the acronym LOL, I suppose to laugh out loud, many people used to think it was lots of love. But yeah, that's another sort of issue in terms of areas relating to this. Is it something to do with our national culture? Has that been affected? Is it the media that's kind of raised expectations and we sort of feel we need to jump straight into the loving scenario as opposed to simply liking somebody and then actually building from there?
I suppose if you think about it, you know, popular culture in terms of films and programmes, we see a lot of drama. We see a lot of high-intensity romance on the screen.
In fact,
and the small screen.
Would Love Island be as successful if we just called it Acquaintance Island?
Oh, Love Island. Do you know what? That's a really good point, because the very fact that we put love in that title, when in fact really it's a bunch of strangers in the exotic heat rubbing sun oil, I mean, I'm not sure that we could really call that love. But I have spoken, and we've done work with... Love Island, you know, last year we did a campaign, a PR campaign with Laura from Love Island, who, poor Laura, got dumped about 4 times on the show. But she said when you're in that house, when you're in that microcosm, everything is so intense and it moves so quickly that you kind of lose a sense of real time. So actually you get to know people really quickly at a really sort of deep level and it feels like love.
I was intrigued to find that it was men under 35 are most likely to drop the L word early on in their relationship. Do you think that's because men are becoming more needy?
Oh, that's really cynical. Men aren't becoming needy. I think they're becoming more loving.
Okay.
I mean, it's interesting that it's men, because actually we thought at eHarmony that it'd be women. Women would be the people that would be more forthcoming. But if you think about it, traditionally, it's men that are still kind of meant to propose. And often are the ones that are seen as, you know, when once the man makes a commitment, you're up and running. So, you know, despite being a fairly modern bunch these days, I suppose some of these cultural cues still exist, and men perhaps feel that they're obligated to say it first.
Intriguing that many people actually prioritise meeting the parents before dropping the L-bomb, and 13% take a holiday first, which is rises in fact to more than a quarter of Londoners who head off on the whole sort of system. Sometimes people say we tend to fall in love more rapidly when there's a crisis, a national crisis or something, and who knows, we may be heading straight into one with respect to current political situations. But in terms of that, and let's not talk about prime ministers arguing with their partners, although we could, but that's a different line entirely. Do you think that is also something where people tend to almost be nudged into the whole notion of saying, well, you know, it's time to actually say I appreciate you and I love you?
I think that, I mean, we're talking about high-intensity relationships in a way, and whether you're a prime minister in waiting, a pop star, an everyday person, if you're somebody that's sort of very extrovert and goes in for a kind of high-drama, high-intensity type relationship, then it may be that I love you is something that is said more often, but it could also swing the other way and be sort of, you know, war and peace, war and peace. I think the important thing is that relationships should ideally complement your lifestyle. They should complement your professional life and be a sort of source of support. But that's not to say that people don't have different ways of expressing love. And I know people that do have quite high intensity, high conflict relationships, but they've also been together many, many years and are very much in love. So it's sort of horses for courses.
Perhaps we need to actually sign a kind of prenuptial agreement before actually uttering the words and sort things out on that basis, because it could lead to all sorts of challenges, but maybe not. Rachel, where can people go to find out further information about eHarmony and, in particular, this little survey?
Well, I would love them to Google eHarmony dating advice, because we've got all sorts of articles about this kind of thing and lots of advice for people there.
Rachel Lloyd, we knew it was going to be absolutely sensational, and so it proved to be. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
I'm feeling very loving towards you.
This is good. This is good. Steady. Just hold on. Will you then be kind enough to possibly return in the near future and continue our very platonic, very positive relationship?
I would love to.
Yay, and we love the lionesses as well. Great stuff. There's only one phrase we can use to wrap up the programme, which we'll do in a few seconds, obviously, after we do our mini roll of honour. Thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Dr. Mark Neath, Stephanie Kane, Rhiann Allen, Faye White, Karen Penny, and of course Rachel Lloyd, and of course Professor Martin Green as well, earlier talking about Care Home Friday, which is on tomorrow. Have you enjoyed your midweek drive morning edition today, Josephine?
I have, yes. Very much looking forward to doing some more.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to do a pre-record about batteries in a few seconds. It's amazing. And Fergus, has it been good for you?
Yes.
Splendid. So I take it we'll be back in the very near future, which is great stuff. Next week, already looking ahead to exciting times when hopefully we'll be celebrating the joys of success as England women target the third successive semi-final, and hopefully we'll go one better this time around, or at least two better actually, and bring the trophy home from France. Lord knows we need it given some of the other political situations we'll be talking about today, which we won't speak of now because it's time to move on. A quick reminder that at 7 o'clock this evening we have got another fabulous edition of Sound and Nick's Vision that comes through. No, it's not Sound and Nick's Vision this evening. It's something completely different. There's all sorts of good things happening on Siren Radio. That's it. We're out of here for the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. The last Midweek Drive Morning Edition for June 2019. What do we wrap up with? Well, I think it's fair enough. Three little words. Come on, England. One, two, three.
Come on, England.